I'd like to begin today to discuss the readings in the book that we are to read for the final exam and the journal, etc., volume 19, number 1, the use and the misuse of language. I will try today also to keep in mind the book that you're going to be having an exam over next time. Incidentally, I called Iowa Book and Supply just now because I'd heard that there were some of you trying to buy it in the last few days who couldn't get it. It's a little late to be trying to buy it, but if I could help you, I wanted to, and I talked to the manager over there. He said that they might have some tomorrow. They'd ordered some more when this new flurry of orders started coming in. But if you can't get it, I hope you can borrow one or get it at the library or something. The ideal way, as I hope I said often enough at the beginning of the course, is to read all the readings in the first month. Then you know what we're talking about during the course. Then you can review for exams. That's one thing, but to cram for one, for something that you have never read before, this, I think, is really not at all an efficient way to take a course of any kind. Get the reading done the first few weeks, then review. This makes a much more efficient way, I think. Well, that advice is free, whatever value that you may find in it. I was asked a while ago to try to relate Young's book a little more, if I would, to the course, to general semantics. I suppose I might do this in what I want to say today. I'll try to keep it in mind. We have been up to the time we began to study Young's book, and through that also, to a large degree, we've been trying, as I see it, to do two things: to learn a language and to find out what the language is about. To learn a language for talking about language, or to learn languages for talking about language, if you prefer. And we've been trying to assemble some information that can be assembled, organized by means of such language or languages. Now, in the course, I also at the end try to provide some readings of the kind we have in this book, The Use and Misuse of Language, and in the journal, etc., which represent something in the way of applications of this language. The language designed to talk about language, to examine language, and to examine its relationships to behavior and to society. To, that is, the behavior of individuals and the behavior of groups. General semantics, as I understand it, and try within the limits of my ability to present it, is a field of study that is concerned with the behavior that we refer to by such names as symbolization, abstracting, language behavior, And there are many approaches to this kind of behavior. I've listed some of the words which are used to refer to various ways of studying language behavior in its various forms and aspects and relationships. In general, if you will examine that list of words, you will probably agree that they could almost be distributed along a continuum from those which refer to kinds of study which are very, very closely focused upon language in terms of phonetics, grammar of language, to those which are concerned with the relationships between language, however described, and behavior of individuals or groups, and the problems of individuals or groups, as these may be studied by examining the language behavior components of the problems. In general, the words I've listed first, linguistics, semantics in the old sense of the term, semiotics, the word semantics goes back roughly to the 1890s when it was introduced as we use it today, and its original meaning was quite restricted. It was concerned pretty much with what we would mean by the meanings of words. But the verbal meanings, it was of interest mainly to dictionary makers, to lexicographers. It was expanded somewhat in its meaning by Richards in The Meaning of Meaning, the book The Meaning of Meaning. At least he developed various kinds of meanings of meaning. He elaborated the meaning concept quite considerably. But and the word syntactics again is pretty much is a term that refers to pretty much to the study of language restricted to language itself, as it were. The relationships of words to words, the way we construct sentences, etc. Lexicography refers to dictionary making. This is a kind of science. Dictionaries are made by gathering behavioral data, by gathering examples of the ways in which words are used in context. And a dictionary is a kind of a report on the history of word usage. But again, it is pretty much limited to that. The dictionary maker has very little to say, as a rule, about the relationship of what he does to human behavior or to social institutions and to social problems. Even the kind of approach to the problem that we have lately begun to talk about as information theory is pretty restricted in its scope to the problem of the transmission of information, the means of transmitting information, and the problems that are encountered in doing this, and the machines that are constructed with which to do it, etc. The computer. Now this, any very thorough investigation of computers and their uses, of course, immediately gets you into sociology and economics and studies of technology and industry and the social effects and the political effects of this, etc. General semantics, there's a very frank attempt to deal with problems that can be worded in terms of the relationship between language, between symbolization, and the abstracting process, especially projection, and the use of language in abstracting, to other forms of behavior, or to other aspects of behavior, and to social problems, and to matters of social organization, behavior of individuals or groups. And you go on to anthropological linguistics and to cultural anthropology, and much the same thing can be said. People in these fields are very much interested in the relationship of language, of a culture, to the culture, and to the behavior of the persons in the culture, and to the institutions of the culture, the child-rearing practices of the culture, etc. And I've added experimental psychology of language, I suppose I should add, because in the last 5 or 6 years, it's hard to attach beginning dates, but there's been an upsurge of interest among psychologists in what they call verbal behavior as a rule, and a tremendous amount of research now going on that has to do with verbal learning, conditioning of verbal responses. For the most part, it's rather restricted in focus to what those words tend to represent. There is some interest among some psychologists in the relationship of what they are able to demonstrate in their studies of verbal conditioning to learning, the learning process, and to neuroses, to maladjustments, or to development of children, normal development. Now, the approach then of a general semanticist in this whole field, if it is distinctive at all, it is in the emphasis which the general semanticist puts upon the study of the relationship between language behavior and all that that means, and other aspects of behavior of individuals and groups. Now, the readings then that you have in these two sources very definitely reflect that. The journal published by the International Society for General Semantics, etc., tends to contain articles that reflect that concern with the relationship between language behavior and other things, especially social problems and individual problems. There are articles, too, which are concerned with trying to trace out the historical antecedents of present-day linguistic science, communication science, including general semantics. There's a very fascinating article in this issue on the Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu. Do I pronounce it? Does anybody here can pronounce it? There's another article about the 17th century semanticists, as the author calls it. There's a good deal of this kind of scholarly work that goes on, in which the antecedents of present day concern with these problems are studied. Other than that, most of the articles are concerned with what you would probably call real problems, current problems of one type or another. Some of them border on research reports. Others are largely attempts to point out what the problems might be, how they might be worded, how they might be approached, talked about. They are discussions. Their value is largely heuristic. That is to say, they tend to stimulate you to think about possibilities that you would not otherwise have thought of, in the way of the way that problems can be formulated and attacked. Now, in order to develop then the discussion along this line of the approach, the study of problems of the relationship between language and other aspects of behavior or social phenomena, I want to remind you of a diagram and talk a little about it in this particular context that we're going to go up today. You remember this, perhaps, as a diagram which is intended to represent the body or the person, as you prefer, or you can use both words. This is a sensory input and the verbal output or symbolic output. It can be gestures, it could be oil paintings, it could be music, or it can be propositions, it can be poetry or puns or weather reports. These are designed to represent filters or processes going on inside the body. Factors is another word that we would use for attitudes, interests, anxieties, assumptions, beliefs, patterns of thinking, the language structure, which the structure of the language one uses. Again, that's what's meant to be represented there. Now, with this simple diagram, you can pretty well describe or formulate the basic field of investigation and study that we're concerned with. The basic question, is, what is the relationship between the sensory input and the verbal output? Insofar as we're going to focus upon the language filter, as it were, the language factor, the symbolization process goes on in the nervous system, what is its relationship to the verbal output? To what extent does your language put words in your mouth? To what extent can it be said, or to put it in the form of a question, can it be said that to any extent, in any way, your language does your thinking for you? You've got to define thinking when you ask this. You have to define language. You can ask, as we had earlier, what determines what you say? What determines a verbal output? To what degree
are the language factors,
to what degree are they responsible for the verbal output? Not only in terms of the words used, but the forms. What kinds of sentences do you make? How would you describe their structure? What kinds
of forms are you able to utilize or try to relate what you say to what you take in?
There are other problems that have to do with the correlation between, or the relationship between, the forms of our languages, and the forms of our social organization. As we have said before, you can talk about a society as a communication network. Well, first of all, in what way can you? What would you write in the way of a report if you did this? If you tried to describe the University of Iowa as a communication network, what would you say? How would you go about this? What kind of data would you gather? What sort of observations would you make? Where would you make them? How would you report them? These are questions that I think obviously you could answer, and you could proceed, and you could describe the University of Iowa as a communication network. Well, having done this, you would have something to say about the structure of this network, and then you could relate that, or could examine it to see if there is any possible relation to the structure of the language that is used in the communication network by the people who use it. And this is a way of asking, is there any relationship between the language which you use, which we all use together as a society, and that is between the structure of that language and the structure of the society. These are empirical questions which you can investigate if you care to. And you can go on to make some generalizations in terms of this kind of a scheme. You can even begin immediately to formulate some possible hypotheses about what these relationships might be that you're going to investigate. It's possible to formulate the hypothesis that there is a very, very close relation between the sensory input and the verbal output, that regardless of what goes on here, regardless of any internal factors, observers looking at the same events will report them the same. This is one hypothesis. But these factors are not important. Now, if you don't like that, or whether you do or not, it doesn't matter. There are others. Possible hypotheses. One is that the verbal reports of different observers will always be different in ways that can be more or less predictable and describable. And then you can begin to attempt to explain these differences. And to bring language into focus here, you can say that the language that the person uses has nothing to do with this. This is one hypothesis. Or you can formulate the kind of a hypothesis that was formulated by Whorf, to the effect that there is a relationship between language and what we say, that the language forms tend to determine the verbal output. He put it in terms of a relationship between language and thought. mostly discussing what people say.
No, it was language and verbal output, language and statement. We were talking about language form and language statement.
And you can develop this to, in these terms, it's possible
some individuals, the verbal output, what people say,
in some cases can be accounted for if you know enough about.
One way to say it is what the individuals have said in the past. And this is a way of saying, if you know enough about the individual's habitual patterns of thought or patterns of belief or attitude or whatever words you want to take responsibility for defining. You can, in terms like this, also set out to investigate the individual differences among persons with regard to the degree to which they vary or are modifiable in the internal factors which determine the verbal output. How changeable are they? You're dealing, what I'm trying to refer to here mainly is the revision, the capacity for revision, the revision ability, the revisionary behavior, the limits of it, the forms that it takes. Well, these are then some of the kinds of problems that you would be concerned with if you are, shall we say, practicing general semanticist. Now, with that kind of orientation, I'd like to read with you or to wonder with you about some of the things that are in this book, the use and disuse of language, the use and misuse of it. I hope you've read it. It's a little hard to tell you about it if you haven't. If you think this is dull, and you are kind of putting it off, I suggest that you begin. I'll bet that you would be interested in, well, there are three articles here, especially. One is called Sexual Fantasy and the 1957 Car. Another one is called Why the Edsel Laid an Egg. Remember the Edsel? Another one is called Popular Songs Versus the Facts of Life. Now, if you don't find these things interesting, I think your nearest of kin should be notified. And I think it's all right to try to get you to read the book, because once you get into it, I think you'll read the rest of it. That's my prediction. It's of no interest particularly, but I'm trying to say to you, if you haven't begun to read it yet, that I don't really believe you need to be too concerned and put it off too much because you think you won't be interested. Incidentally, the first article is one of these more or less scholarly things by Anatole Rapoport. What is Semantics is the title of it, and he discusses some of the various approaches that I've listed on the board to the study of the kind of thing that we've been talking about. And it helps you to clarify, I think, what kind of a course you've been in. Now, let me just take a few moments to point to some of these articles. These are all articles from the journal, etc.
past issue. I'll say enough about them to help you, perhaps, to get set for what to expect and possibly how these articles differ and so on. There's one early in the book, the second one, by Irving Lee, called Why Discussions Go Astray. This is, in effect, a rather, it represents a way to report, a kind of observation. This is essentially research, but it is not research in a highly designed, rigorously designed type. Irving Lee simply reports in here some of the work that he develops more in detail in the book, How to Talk with People. You remember, perhaps, that this is a report of his observations which he made by sitting at the side of the room, as it were, observing 200 board meetings, 200 committee meetings, board meetings, just observing as best he could the problems that the members of the boards and committees had talking with each other. And in this article, he gives some of his main observations as he evaluated them, some of the more important ones. There is an article that follows that by Roethlisberger from Harvard. He is in the Harvard School of Business Administration. This article, which is entitled Barriers to Communication Between Men, this article has been reprinted probably more than most articles ever get reprinted. It's been widely reprinted in books, textbooks, books of readings, magazines, and it's a very simple sort of article about two ways for men to communicate with each other. And the one is very effective, and the other is very disruptive of relationships. I don't know how much to tell you about what's in these articles. I don't think I'll do that, because you're going to be reading them anyway. I merely want to point out some of the variety that you observe when people begin to try to apply or to examine their world from this kind of a point of view. What do they look for? And what kinds of problems do they focus upon? There are a number of articles here that are written by people who work in the news gathering professions and the news reporting professions. General Semantics and the Reporter's Job by Donald Schwartz. This man went with a reporter of the New York Times and followed him from the beginning to an end of an assignment, and looked at it he observed what the man did from the point of view of a student of general semantics. He had taken a course general semantics in the School of Journalism at the University of Missouri. The dean of the school down there teaches a course in general semantics. He took this course when he was here in Iowa and has been teaching a course there ever since, which all the students in journalism at school take. Well, here's one of the graduates of the course who now did this type of thing. And it's quite a revealing report of what are some of the problems of the reporter. It makes you a more intelligent newspaper reader. There's another article like this also, on page 112, which is entitled "The Process of News Reporting" by Ken McCrory. And these two articles, I think, will make much more interesting for you any newspaper, including the Daily Iowan, or the Des Moines Register, or the New York Times. There are, after all, some observations to be made about the behavior which is gone through in the production of what we call the news. The news, the production of the news every day is rather obviously an abstracting process on a grand scale. And abstracting can be defined in part as the leaving out of details. And it is very important to have some appreciation of the details left out of your newspaper. It's very important if you are going to understand not just this kind of reporting, but any kind, that which goes on in the laboratories of the nation. To some degree, what we call the lack of understanding on the part of, first of all, maybe congressmen, to the rest of the taxpayers and to the general public, as we say, these are loose words, in some measure what we call the lack of understanding of research, of the use, for example, of the millions and millions of dollars that Congress appropriates every year for research. The lack of understanding of that, so far as that exists, is due, I think, or can be talked about, shall we say, in terms of what people do not know about what does not get reported from the laboratories. Anybody, what you learn by working in a laboratory is largely the kind of thing you learn by working on a newspaper. You learn what doesn't get reported. You learn what doesn't get included in the technical articles in the journals, for example. I think almost all of us would agree, I believe we would, that most of the technical, professional, scientific journals make very, very dull reading. I think anyone also would agree that there's a way to make them very interesting, but I doubt if it will be done. And that would be to include all the things that the scientific writer leaves out. All the things that go on in the laboratory that are terribly interesting because they involve human beings behaving the way human beings usually behave. And you could write an Earl Wilson column out of the laboratories every day. And it would make science much more interesting than it tends to be. And much more understandable, too. You'd get a much better perspective on it. I guess we're there. Et cetera. Oh, I should tell you, the exam has two questions. suggested time for each is 25 minutes. That is your design to divide the time, the hour. And you should bring your book, Doubt and Certainty in Science. It will help to have it with you. For the one question, I make reference to many of the page references. You really should have a copy of that book. Now, if you don't have, borrow your seat neighbors, I guess, if you need to.